I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation about the book The Life of Hinduism with its co-editors, Jack Stratton Hawley and Vasudha Narayanan. The Life of Hinduism is a book that has multiple authors with multiple essays, and it is quite fascinating as it attempts to give us a picture of life, the life of Hinduism as it is lived in this 21st century. A little bit about our guests today. Jack Hawley is a professor of religion at Barnard College, Columbia University. He has directed the university's South Asia Institute and has received multiple awards from NEH, the Smithsonian, and the AIIS. He's been a Guggenheim Fellow and was recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 2016 and 17, he's been in India as a Fulbright Nehru Fellow, working on a project called The New Vrindavan. Vasudha Narayanan is a distinguished professor of the Department of Religion at the University of Florida and past president of the American Academy of Religion. She was educated at the universities of Madras and Bombay in India and here at Harvard University. Her fields of interest are the Hindu traditions in India, Cambodia, and America. We welcome, once again to Common Threads, Jack Hawley and Vasudha Narayanan. Hello to you both.
Hi, Fred.
Thank you for joining us once again. We had a wonderful conversation last week, and there are many questions that I still have, and I'm sure things that you'd like to share. Talking about the book and the various authors that make up this book, that contributed to it, you wanted to get a sense, as we mentioned last week, for anyone who might have missed last week's show, you wanted to be able to show Hinduism as life lived today. And from what we gathered last week, the contributions are pretty much about Hinduism today, with not a lot of ink spent on ancient Hinduism, although, of course, ancient Hinduism clearly affects the Hinduism today quite strongly, as one would expect. So when you and your colleagues created this, did you have a particular person in mind? Is this more, do you consider it more of an academic work? Do you think that people who are simply people who are interested in Hinduism but not in the academic arena, do you think that it is appropriate for them as well?
Go for it, Vasu.
Oh, I think it's primarily intended for an academic audience, especially undergraduate. But I think I certainly feel that an anyone interested in the field, in the subject, can probably pick it up and recognize much of Hinduism in it. I would also say, speaking for myself, I've learned a lot from writings by Hindus about Hinduism. And I hope that some of my fellow Hindus can also read this and appreciate it or find something intriguing in it, something they disagree with, but many things that they recognize as being part of the tradition. I think this was one of the main reasons we included a piece by Om Lata Bahadur. Jack, do you remember that piece on the celebration of Deepavali? So we paired it, that section on the celebration of festivals, one with a Western academic writing about Holi, an anthropologist, and it's a very classical essay on Holi. And we try to pair it with a person who celebrates Diwali as a Hindu. And what's important, it's the eating, the festivities, the sweets, the celebrations, and so on. In India, one doesn't sit and philosophize about the celebration. We are called upon constantly to do that and explain that in this country. And yes, it's true that all our festivals, almost all, have to do with the triumph of good over evil. So people get a little tired of hearing that for every festival. But it's, but we wanted to get a voice which speaks about how do you make laddus or how do you make this dish? This is what really occupies our minds when we're dealing with Deepavali in India.
Yeah, if I can jump in, I love the pairing of these two essays. They're the two essays that are included in the festival section of the book. And I'm actually opening to page 98 and 99, which I hope would be pages that would interest sort of anybody who goes to a public library in, you know, Cupertino, California, and wants to see, okay, what is Hinduism about? Someone from the outside, or someone who's getting off the plane in Delhi and just about to, you know, come into India for the first time. I would hope this book would be a real resource for such a person. So looking at these two essays, the one by McKim Marriott, it is, of course, an essay by someone who comes from the outside. Listen to his name, McKim Marriott, but someone who has invested his life in the study of India. And it's an essay by an anthropologist, but it's really about the anthropologist. What happened to him when he experienced his first holi in North India? Well, he doesn't know too much because he drank a little bhang. It was a special beverage that was offered to him, and lo and behold, he doesn't remember very much about the rest of the festival. So it's about the outsider encountering something that really he had no idea was going on. Then he comes back after a year and takes a look at who it was that was throwing buffalo piss at him and so forth. It's a wonderful, it's a classic in that sense, a modern classic of an outsider finding himself in an India he hadn't really known. And then just across the page, as Vasu was saying, you have this wonderful essay on Diwali by Omlata Bahadur, also writing in a North Indian context. And the last thing she gives us, since she's writing especially for other women who are in the position of recreating these festivals, perhaps in places where their grandmothers aren't present to give them the information they need about how it should be done, she gives us a recipe for a thing called mandi, which looks quite delicious. And if you want to, you know, make it and happen to have all the ingredients right there in your kitchen in, okay, Cupertino, you can do it.
And in fact, this is obviously before the advent of Internet, which took place,
yes,
which takes the place of a grandma here.
Yeah,
and all the ingredients are now available, of course, through Amazon.com.
Right.
So I think we're in business here. But Fred, to go back to your earlier question of how we chose some of the topics, I think a central feature of Hinduism, as anyone will recognize, is going to a temple and having darshan. So we saw this kind of theme of going to a temple, of approaching God, of what do you see, what do you mean by darshan, would be extremely important. What does it mean to be a Hindu in a diaspora? And why did people build the first temple in this country? Why is temple worship so important here? Now, the Pittsburgh Temple arguably was one of the first, alongside the one in Queens, New York. And now, of course, every small town has a temple. We're looking at Salt Lake City. It's just not a small town, a big one, but not the first place you'd go to for a Hindu temple. But many of the towns, which are not just New York or San Francisco, we have temples in practically every state, in the really small towns, and people are here to stay. So the temples in themselves make a clear point that this is the latest mix of immigrants in this country who are very much at home now.
And that's really why Vasu and I wanted to start with the section we call worship, because we wanted to sort of get people into a worship setting. Virtually, they're reading a sense of, you know, what it's like, but to sort of urge people to go ahead and make a visit. If you go to suppose you're not Hindu, but you know that there are Hindu places, Hindu temples, and perhaps retreat centers nearby you. Fred, I happen to know you're talking from Grand Rapids. You can make it over to Ganges, Michigan, actually, right there on the shores of Lake Michigan, and walk into an ashram, and so can anybody who lives in the Grand Rapids area. It's a wonderful aspect of Hindu hospitality that you'll be welcomed there. So just wanted to make it possible for people who might feel this tradition condition in some way to be strange or a challenge to things that they themselves have grown up with, to be able to feel comfortable and in going through that door, going down to Ganges, Michigan, and to expect that they would be welcomed and that they would find things about being there that would be both familiar and unfamiliar, but worth thinking about and worth experiencing.
Actually, if you go to Ganges, you now have the option of going to two ashrams.
Mother's place?
That's correct. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Vivekananda
right across,
Monastery.
Right across the street.
Yes, that
and
is
then
right.
We also have Swami Bodhananda's retreat in Michigan.
Yes, yes, near Kalamazoo. Oh, yeah,
that's
believe
near
me.
Kalamazoo, quite correct.
Certainly. No, there are multiple places here in Michigan, and I know in the Detroit area.
There are many temples.
Yes,
and
yes.
And in fact, it's a splendid illustration. Detroit, when they first started with temples there, they had an all-inclusive South Asian Indian temple. By Indian temple, we mean north and south, a combination, and they call it a Bharatiya temple, which is also the name of the temple in East Lansing.
Yes.
But once we have more than a small number of Hindus there, we begin to have the South Indian temples. So you have one in Novi, and then right outside Detroit area, a South Indian temple largely devoted to one of the most popular manifestations of Vishnu in this country called Venkateshwara. And multiple temples devoted to the smaller communities who hail from India.
Over on the north side of the city, I'm thinking of Troy and the Parashakti temple there. And it's not just a temple there, because they also have I'm on their email list. So whenever a new festival or something new is happening in the temple, I find out about it virtually sitting right here in New York, and know that next time I go to the Detroit area, as I often do, I should make a visit and find out what's going on in the temple.
No, and what's fascinating, I don't know if you might use this term or not, but trying to explain the North Indian temples, or rather the North Indian tradition, the South Indian tradition, Hindu temples in the United States tend to be ecumenical. That is to say, right, that multiple movements and sects can find representation in one temple. You don't have that, I don't believe, in other religious traditions, at least not to the extent, right? So you can have your, for instance, the local temple here, you've got a Murti of Swami Narayan, right? And you also have another one of Shirdi Sai Baba. And then you have the various deities. And you've got so many people who are focused on this tradition or that tradition, but they're all in the same place, and they all celebrate one another's holy days more often than not. Am I correct? Is this must be a trend nationwide, is it not?
Well, so you've been sort of emphasizing the opposite point, that as more and more Hindus gather in the United States.
No, I'm sorry. I'm speaking. Let me clarify that originally, when you have smaller communities, these temples were ecumenical, and that there's no problem with North people, South people, Vaishnav, Shaivites, all the various expressions gathering together. And before you answer that, I do want to just mention that if people are tuning in right now, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. We're talking to two guests who are co-editors of the book The Life of Hinduism, and that is Jack Stratton Holly and Vasudha Narayanan. So go ahead and respond to that.
Well, I would think, Fred, just like everything else in Hinduism, you could say yes and no to the same thing. And I would say there are both centrifugal and centripetal forces in effect here. In some, we have communities coming together, at least in the initial stages, both North and South Indian and part of different sectarian movements coming together. But once there are financial and people resources, people feel like comfort food, They like to have their own temple with their own, with the deities that they're familiar with. And that's why we have a proliferation of Hindu temples in this country. For instance, in Florida, we have not just North or South Indian temples, but the Caribbean temples as well.
Mm.
So people who come from Trinidad are comfortable with their own temples and the way they worship, and which is quite distinct from, say, the way people, the Hindus, many of the Hindus worship in South Asia. So in Trinidad, because of the long legacy and the history, the indentured workers could only get to worship on Sunday mornings, Christian style. So there is a congregation there, and many of the temples are open only on Sundays. And when a new temple or a new teacher comes from elsewhere and settles in Trinidad, you know the difference. There's a kind of a Trinidadian Hinduism in the one sense, mm-hmm. but it shares a commonality with other aspects of Hindu traditions in India, kind of like a Venn diagram. But in practice, they like to do what their parents did, and again, custom and practice here. So that becomes significant. So we have multiple kinds of temples, and every one of them is a joy to go to. And of course, food abounds in just about every one of them.
So I wonder what you'd say about this, though. It seems to me that, you know, sometimes to take the comparison with Christianity, that doctrinal differences can really be a big obstacle between groups that belong to Protestants. They can be a big obstacle to people getting together. There's certainly exceptions to the rule. What I would say is that despite this, you called it comfort food approach, you know, wanting to feel truly at home in a worship setting or a community setting to which you belong, there is a characteristic generosity that comes from the basic perception that manyness is the norm, that the world is made up of many different kinds of peoples and communities. People see things from different points of view and perspectives. We come into the world in fundamentally different ways, and the treasuring of that sense of plurality doesn't go away just because people find themselves worshiping with or being with or celebrating festivals with people who are more like themselves than like others.
And again, there are exceptions here. There are some communities which are a little bit more insular than others, but on the whole, I would think we tend to share the space, both the literal physical space as well as festival space and doctrinal space in this country and in India with many other people, and not just with Hindus, but as you well know, with Christians and Muslims as well, in particular measure.
In fact, there's a wonderful little chapter in this book that Vasu herself wrote that has to do with a particular place in South India where the temple elephant is named Fatima.
Yeah.
It's
not a temple, it's a Dargah elephant.
It's a Dargah, actually.
Yeah, the Dargah elephant.
More.
And the land for that Dargah being a holy place where both Muslims and Hindus go, it's a place where Muslim saints, I'm using the word saints in quotation marks, are buried and revered both by Hindus and Muslims. And the land for the Dargah was given, as in many other cases, by a Hindu king.
Yes.
And these are shared spaces of worship, while the news media frequently focuses on the antagonistic relationships between the religions. We should also look at the many shared spaces between Hindus and Muslims, Hindus and Christians in the subcontinent. So if you go to Bangalore, for instance, there's a shrine for the infant Jesus. And many of the people who come there, the pilgrims, are Hindus. And you find that in not just one Dargah, which is the focus of my article, but, you know, hundreds of them, literally, in South India. And, of course, the famous ones in Delhi, Jack.
Absolutely.
And from what I gather, and tell me if I'm wrong, that there is so much more cooperation amongst the various religions in India, as opposed to the tragic communal violence that is a reality, but that on a day-to-day basis, the people work and live pretty well together. Am I correct?
I would agree. Absolutely. I would say yes to that.
I agree, too. They're probably too dangerous to get into, you know, talk of politics these days, but UP is where I usually am. I've been working on a project in Vrindavan, and the capturing of the UP government by the BJP, by the Bharatiya Janata Party, has certainly exacerbated some tensions that were not there earlier. And I know this because of talking with some of my Muslim friends who now feel more at an arm's length from governmental processes than they did before the elections were won. So I think one doesn't want to whitewash this. There's in the chapter that I wrote that's near the one we were just talking about that Vasu wrote, I talk about going to Ayodhya in the year, a month actually, after the Babri Mosque was pulled down by Hindu militant activists. You know, these are very important events, and they have shaped the present day realities of what it is to be a Hindu, not just in India but around the world. There too, as in many other situations, these are not just Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Sikh, as a matter of fact, you name it, Buddhist, as we can see. The, you know, nationalism and nationalist ideologies and the investment of religion can go hand in hand. It's something that every religious tradition has to face. So we wanted to also bring that forward in the book. One thing that I found to be absolutely remarkable in going to Ayodhya in January of 1993 was that I was with a Hindu friend, and we were searching actually for the tomb of the person who had built the Babri Mosque. We weren't able to find it, but it meant that we stumbled into a place that where indeed the attackers on the mosque had also created a fair amount of destruction. They had destroyed a dargah and damaged a mosque. The person who came forward to explain to us the site where we were was a tailor, actually, by profession, a Muslim. And he said, you know, it's just a terrible tragedy. These people have come in from the outside, and they have disrupted the kind of situation, Vasu, that you described in South India, where the Urs, the special day for the saint in question, was celebrated not just by Muslims living in that area, but also by Hindus. And in his opinion, there were probably more Hindus there than Muslims. So the very, my habit of saying, oh, there's a Muslim and there's a Hindu, may not actually be an accurate habit for that place. It's a very complicated reality, and one of my hopes, at least, is that by studying it as we meet it in these various parts of the book, it'll make people ask not just about the complexity of the Hindu tradition, which is kind of famous in the world, but also about the complexity of other religious traditions where complexity is not so welcomed at an official level.
What you just said in the end, where the complexity is not welcomed in an official level, I think that's a very important point for many religious traditions now, where it seems to be that we have an ideal Hindu or a high ideal Muslim or an ideal way of living, which is more monolithic and more monochromatic, I would say, than the rich diversity of a tradition that's presented. So there are many ways of being Hindu, and quote-unquote in authentic ways. And in fact, when we come to America, and I came to America, I learned to be Hindu in a very different way than I was than my grandmother was. And one would argue that that's true in India too. So I think both mass media, the forces of globalization, have on the one hand made it a rich diversity of possibilities of what we can be in any Hindu tradition, with more festivals than what my parents or my grandparents would celebrate. At my disposal, it's almost like a buffet table now. I mean, with more Hindu festivals, I didn't know about Holi growing up. And it was only when I was in college. But now with mass media, that's really these festivals or Karwa Chauth, which women did only in North India. Women in South India are doing that now.
Yeah.
But with all of that, there is still this kind of strong, strident voice coming from different quarters saying, this is what all Hindus should believe in, this is what they should be doing, and this is, and everything else is wrong. That's never been the spirit of Hinduism. But you can also argue that's the way it's been with Islam and many other religions too. And so with these forces competing for space in India and other places, I think we're ready for a new edition of this book.
Already. And I heard one Hindu say, he was asked the question, do you have a Sabbath? And his response was, are you kidding? With all of our festivals, if we had one, we'd never work.
But the reality is, of course, that there is now a Sabbath in Hindu life. Sunday really makes a difference, certainly in the United States for many Hindu communities, but also in India itself these days. So, you know, yeah, and yeah. Let me just say, since you asked me about this last week, Fred, that,
yes.
You know, how I came to this, we won't go through that story. But I come from a Protestant Christian background. Vasu was speaking about her grandmother. I had a grandfather who was actually, you know, the minister of the First Congregational Church in Ames, Iowa. My life with Hinduism, and I do have a life with Hinduism, my life with Hinduism has taught me, has helped me to be, if I may say so, Christian in a way that otherwise would not have been possible. I think of left and closed it down. When I go to church, and I still do go to church, boy, you know, if I hear, as I did this last Sunday, if I hear a cantata written by Bach, I know that that's bhakti that I'm hearing. It's about the importance of music as a vocabulary of religious experience. Music in its own right. There are words there, but until they become made music, once they're made music, they're not the same. Hindus have really understood that.
And on that note, I want to thank both of you so much for your time with us this week and last week as well. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to you.
Thank you so much, Fred, for having us.
Today and last week as well, we've had it as our guests Jack Hawley and Vasudha Narayanan, the co-editors of The Life of Hinduism. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.